back, folks. Good to have you with us here on the Mark Steiner Show and your source for cool jazz and more. WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And as you know, we're convening many different kinds of panels since the election and over the next month as we look at what this Trump presidency will mean and what our response should be. We're looking to put together a panel in the next coming days actually with a group of conservatives and where they think this is going. Looking at it with from a Native American perspective, from the perspective of women, from lots of different groups about where we're going to take this. Our panel today really is a spectrum of people from the progressive left, liberal perspective in America of where we're taking what this means, what we've seen over the weekend, the choices Trump just made for top leaders of the White House, but more importantly, what the response should be. There's a strange normalization taking place in the major mainstream media and among many Democratic leaders. But there were protests across America, tens and tens of thousands of people marching in cities across the country, from Massachusetts to Baltimore to California to Madison to Florida to Texas, everywhere, Nevada. And so we are going to talk about all that today and more, and what this all may mean in the coming months and years. In studio with me are Quincy Gamble, who was a senior advisor to the Clinton campaign in Maryland, former executive director of the Maryland Democratic Party, advisor to Lieutenant Governor Anthony Brown, and political director once upon a time when we first met of 1199 SEIU here in Baltimore. It's been a while. Good to see you, Quincy.
Yes, sir.
The Reverend Merrick Moyes is with us, writer, community activist, teacher, one of the first African Americans ordained in the old Catholic movement, also the first trans person ordained. Am I right about that?
Something like that, in Baltimore.
In Baltimore. Yeah. Okay, I wasn't sure. Anyway, I don't want to give you a title you didn't deserve. And Sarah Van Gelder joins us, executive editor and co-founder of Yes Magazine. Sarah, great to have you back with us as well.
Thanks so much for having me.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. You can write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. You can also tweet us at Mark Steiner. You can, but do join us if you can, 410-319-8888. And Sarah, you've been back and forth to Standing Rock. We want to talk about that as well because I think that plays a major role in what's going to happen next in the next couple of months, what Obama may do, and again, Trump may try to undo, or maybe Obama will do nothing and Trump will still try to undo it. So join us at 410-319-8888. But it does feel like there's been a... From the depressive panic you saw with many people, over half the country that voted against Donald Trump, those who did vote, I should say, and most studies have shown that most people who did not vote also did not support Donald Trump, even though he won with a fewer votes than 48%, I think he won
right.
with. Students have taken to the streets all across America, young people are all across America, as we've seen. But the Democratic establishment and the press have taken kind of a look at this and saying this is a normalcy here. We have transition of power. It's democracy. It's the way it's supposed to work. We should give Trump a chance. And even progressive leaders in Congress, progressive Democrats in Congress, talking about, well, let's see how we can work together, which is their first response. But there's a very divided – the world that was against Trump is a very divided place. So I'm curious where you think this takes it all. Sarah, let me start with you.
Well, I think there's two categories of things that Trump may do. Some are the things that he said he would do that are just outrageous and that he seems actually to be committed to carrying forth. And other things he kind of threw out as sort of little prizes for his conservative base, but then he's backing off already. He's already backing off on things like the question of making gay marriage illegal. So I think we need to, first of all, get really clear on where there's some serious movement that he's actually going to take on some policies that are going to be really troubling and make sure to do everything we can to block those. And at the same time, on the other ones, on things like gay rights that he seems, frankly, less committed on, let's see if we can influence him because there I think we have some better prospects. But I think the bigger picture is what kind of an atmosphere has he created with his hate speech and with the kind of unleashing of the worst, most divisive elements in our country. And there I think we have an ongoing, just a huge task ahead of us to be working every single day, and particularly starting in our own communities, to make it clear that that's not the kind of world that we want, that's not the kind of community that we want, that's not the people that we are, and that we insist that our society be one that includes everyone and where everyone can feel safe.
Eric, you were a Clinton delegate.
I was, and I was just telling Brother here that this is night and just nightmare. This is day and nightmare from when I was at the convention. And one of the things that I'm so thankful that I was there, because one of my takeaways is that the people were not represented. The actual cost to get to the convention was exorbitant. So the people are locked out of the process. And I think that what we really need to decide on is, in terms of the party, is the party as it stands now really in a position to stay together? And if so, what does that look like? I'm not calling for disunity, y'all, so don't email me about that. But I'm talking about when you have party leadership saying, well, we should give him a chance, when there's people's lives on the line right now, getting beat up, harassed, people committing suicide, threats against people's lives, black dolls hanging in effigy, and you want me to give this person a chance to do what? If we look at his 100 days agenda, that agenda reads like a roll call of a horror movie. So what chance are we giving him? Like what are we giving him a chance to literally throw us back 50 to 100 years? Tell me, what chance are we giving this person?
And your nuanced thoughts there?
I'm not sure how Quincy nuanced Gamble. They are, but I'm definitely trying to work through and process this like everyone else. I think what I was telling you guys earlier, the enormity of the shift, it's so big, and there's so much to sort of try to tackle globally. I always think the best step for me personally is to be introspective about the role that I played and I could play moving forward. I've been rocked by this. I mean, I've seen a lot in politics And of course, I'm a party guy, and I was a huge Hillary person. I'm a great admirer of her, flaws and all. But when I say that I did not see this coming, it's incredible. And I should have, because of my own background. And I can say lesson number one for me is this. I know I moved to Baltimore 10 years ago. And since then, my life has become D.C. to the south and Boston to the north. And that's my world. I spend all of my time talking to folks that agree with me 90% of the time, that I believe in, and I am missing so much of what's out there, whether I agree with it or not. To be a better practitioner of politics, let alone a citizen, but to be a better practitioner of politics, we've got to know more about what's out there and what folks are thinking, so we can fashion our case for why we should be in leadership better. We're sitting here at a really difficult time for the party. Both houses of Congress, the White House, the majority of governors, the vast majority of state legislative seats held by Republicans. But we all feel that we're right on all the issues. And I believe we're right on most of the issues, too. But we've got to find a way to make our arguments much more populist, even if they're right. So we've got some work to do as a party.
So Sarah, there's a real question here, and if there's a contradiction between these two things, or a reality where they meet, maybe they don't, is can you build the bridge people are talking about building between these sectors of our country that really don't know each other, don't, and in many ways don't like each other?
Right.
That, in some ways it's not just class, it's built around race. And the fear of race in this country and where America's going, and you see that pretty blatantly, I think. And people are calling for like massive demonstrations and to keep the heat up and not to relent.
Resist
this. But can you do that and build this bridge? And you are in the, you'll be here in next year talking about your book, where you went around all over the country talking to many different kinds of communities. So I'm curious how you view where we are at the moment and where people who are progressive, liberal on the left, and where this, where to go in terms of where the other part of the country has gone.
Yeah, well, thank you for that, Mark. And I think part of what happened is there was an enormous amount of pain happening among the working class of this country, and I mean white, black, all colors, that was not really acknowledged by the Democratic Party establishment. I think the notion that our economy was back at the same time that people were suffering incredibly, there's statistics that half of Americans are living in poverty, huge levels of debt among young people who've tried to get to play the game by the rules and go to college and come out with this enormous debt, millions who lost their homes during the economic recession that was sparked by all that Wall Street speculation, and nobody in Wall Street has paid for that, and that was under our Obama administration. You know, Wall Street got away with just incredible rip-offs of the American people who, as I said, lost jobs and homes and the most basic elements of security, being able to educate their children, have a place to live, have an income. So that level of pain, I think, was simply not acknowledged by either Obama or Senator Clinton. And instead, they were told, oh, actually, things are going pretty well, and we're going to have this great new TPP trade policy, and it's going to be more of the same. And so I think, you know, in U.S. history, when there's enormous economic pain, there is a segment of the population that is prone to turn to bring out the latent racism, which I think remains a factor of American life and always has. But I think they take advantage of the economic pain to use that to spur this kind of racist and xenophobic kind of approach. And that's where I think the Bernie campaign was so powerful, is that he was telling a different story about the cause of the pain. The cause of the pain is a lot more about this system that is allowing the wealth of our country to go to the top 1%. And by the way, we'll get far worse under Trump's tax policies, where all those big tax breaks he's promising, you know, the majority of them will go to the top 1%. Bernie was telling a different story, that we have this issue of massive inequality, and if we want to create a better life, we need to share more broadly. We can't have all the rules and all the advantages go to the super rich. So that was a story people really resonated with. And I'm not going to try to go back and say what might have happened, although polls did show Bernie doing very, very well against Trump. But I know that there's a lot of Bernie supporters who were so turned off by the establishment and the insular sense of the elite on both the Democratic and Republican side, that they were going to go for an outsider regardless. So I think there's a really important lesson there. I just wrote a brief little column on my Facebook page basically suggesting, with all due respect to those on this program, that the Democratic Party establishment should resign. And the party needs to be reconfigured from the grassroots up, getting rid of all the superdelegates, getting rid of that insider elite mentality, and really getting in touch with what's happening at the grassroots across the country, where there is just such pervasive suffering, and people are so ready for change. They're so ready for change, and they're so ready to be part of the change and to dig in and to sacrifice, to work together to make that kind of change. But instead, they're getting this leadership that's all about, well, we have to protect Wall Street, we have to protect the big corporations, we need big trade deals that will help make sure that they can continue making their big money, even if it's at the expense of American workers.
So, you know, let's pick up on that for a moment about where the Democrats might go. I mean, I think that there's both Democrats and Republicans, and a big part of their parties are parties of Wall Street. From the conservative side and liberal side, they're parties of the wealthy, you know, and from liberals and conservative perspectives. And if you look at, you know, that in some ways, you know, if you every time I ask a politician during the course of this election, a local politician here usually, about superdelegates, they were all superdelegates. Don't you think that that's an anti-democratic process, having superdelegates decide what's going to happen at a convention? They all hemmed and hawed and go, oh, well, not really, because, you know, we're elected and that's why we're there, and we're stability for the party. And that's the argument that all these other people used when asked that question. But, you know, you can see it in the vote. I mean, the vote that Hillary got, 59.8 million votes from the last count, down from 69.5 million. When Obama first ran, yes. And Trump won with 700,000 less votes than McCain got in 2008. Mm-hmm. So you know, I think there's an argument made here that if for the Democratic Party to become relevant and move, they have to change, or they split apart like we thought. That many people thought the Republicans were going to split apart,
right?
Until this election took place.
But we have to be clear, like both parties were the leadership of really both parties was decimated during this process, the Republican and the Democratic Party. It's hard for me to draw the connection between the effect of superdelegates to the turnout. I think the turnout was lower because we failed to reconstitute the Obama coalition of younger voters and minority voters that turned out in such big numbers. The places where, first of all, when something this big happens, there's no one thing that went wrong. There's so many things that went wrong, and there's bits and pieces that we all have to learn from. But to me, one of the more sobering elements of this election are how many folks, white voters, working class voters, who voted for Obama and then did not vote for Clinton. That's a huge deal here. I'm less paused. I mean, I worry about the fact that turnout was down, but I didn't expect there to be the same turnout. You can even look at 2010 and 2014 with President Obama stomping really hard for progressives and Democrats, and we still lost both of those elections. You know, in 2014, I had Michelle Obama here the night before Anthony Brown's race, and we still lost because voters just did not turn out the same way when Obama was on the ballot. I think part of that is the effect of his hope and inspiration. A lot of that is the system that we ran in 2008 and 2012, which I'm very familiar with. Things were done differently this time, and we've got to figure out what we can do better.
If I could just interject, I think that part of the issue is politicians are really for real out of touch. And I say that because having worked in the Annapolis space and bringing to Annapolis the stories that I hear through my ministry on the street with marginalized people here, there's just no clue. So I understand the anger. And I will say for the record, I did support Mrs. Clinton for president because I just felt she was the deepest one on the bench, and I do admire her tenacity. That being said, the party itself needs a total reconstitution. I know that a lot of black people were very upset because they perceived that the black vote was not protected in terms of the Voting Rights Act being gutted. And what did the Democrats do to offset that? Because we had precincts, particularly in North Carolina and states involved in voter suppression, that closed ID centers, closed polling places, made it really hard for people to vote. So in that climate, how are we turning out the base? What are the mechanisms that we're using to make sure that the candidate's message also gets out, but that her surrogates or their surrogates are effective in communicating that? And I'm not sure that happened this time. We really have to do a top-down reorganization with the idea that the people come first and what the people want comes first. And I'm not sure that it completely didn't happen in this election, but how can we move forward making sure that the people's concerns are met?
Well, I think, I wanted to pick up something Sarah just said here. Let me open the phones first. I promise I would do that tomorrow for our listeners at 410-319-8888. And Tiffany, you're on the air. Welcome.
To know about the lawsuits against Donald Trump, and is there any chances that he can get impeached? And I'll hang up.
Can Donald Trump be impeached? With a Republican Congress, I doubt it.
Right.
Well, there's a couple of scenarios that Michael Moore and some other folks have come up with around his impeachment, particularly around his business dealings. And because, again, now there's supposed to be a so-called wall that's constructed, and that was walked back because there might be fences in some parts, claims the president-elect, and he knows about construction. So how do we know that this is not a big business ploy, right, to have his people work on the so-called construction of the wall I don't know if he'll be impeached, but I know that people are talking about it. I don't know, but I do know that regardless of what that looks like, that his vice president is scarier. Like, we need to talk about what he looks like as well and his agenda that he's running.
Sarah, what were you about to say?
I wasn't.
Oh, I thought I heard you. I'm sorry.
No.
No, I don't think there's a chance of Donald Trump being impeached at all in any of this. It's not going to happen. But, what could happen, I mean, let's think about the things he said during the campaign. When he talked about deporting people in this country, and he said it again, up to 3 million people could be deported, some of them citizens, promised to create a system of surveillance looking at Muslim Americans, build this wall, which he's backing off a little bit, only because he's not sure he can get it done. Advocated for war crimes, endorsed torture, said he was going to jail Hillary Clinton herself. And the fact that he has
a brain drain.
Yeah.
I mean, doesn't know enough to be president.
But he is going
to
be president.
And we have to, yeah, and we have to.
So, when you see that and you also see that he's put, you know, he made one, he threw a bone to the Republican Party because he needed somebody to establish him to help run his government chief of staff with Pence Priebus. Rance Priebus, excuse me. But
best Steve, friend of Paul Ryan, so that, you know.
But Steve Bannon.
Yeah,
it's terrible.
Serving Elder is a pretty scary idea of having him be the top strategic consultant to the president of the United States.
Absolutely. I mean, Trump built his base on and the enthusiasm of his base on just being absolutely outrageous. And every time he dialed it back, any time his advisors managed to get him to dial it back, you know, the enthusiasm of his base fell. So he understands, I think, very well that he has to keep up that ugliness. And he also evidently wants to get things done in Congress, so he needs the establishment to do that. I think it's interesting to look at some of the things that he's actually said he'll do in his first 100 days, and among them are a ban on White House and congressional officials becoming lobbyists, a ban on White House officials lobbying on behalf of foreign governments, a ban on foreign lobbyists raising money for American elections. So there may be all sorts of partisan reasons he's coming up with some of these things. But there are things that he is suggesting to do that we might actually want him to do. So I think it's really important for us to be really astute about which things are just beyond the pale, that we just have to do whatever we can to block them, to fight them. You know, I'm particularly concerned about the climate arrangements.
That's,
you know, if
we're
actually reaching a really disastrous point on climate change if things continue as they are. There are big questions about whether agriculture can survive, you know, with the droughts that will come with it and the fires. And, you know, I'm out west, and as you said, I traveled around the country, so I saw the impacts of this. And we are right up against some enormous crises in terms of the climate. We finally have an international agreement that he is promising to undermine. That is absolutely disastrous. So, you know, I think we need to be really clear about where are their policies. Like, for example, I happen to agree that the TPP was a disastrous, Trans-Pacific Partnership was a disastrous proposal as it was formulated, and that backing off of that will be a good thing. But on other things like the undercutting the international climate agreement, I think that's disastrous, and we just have to be out there fighting in every way we can.
Well, we have to take a short break here in a moment, but I mean, I'm going to go right to the phones, and Donna and Charles and Donald, Wayne, you're the callers up. We're going to get your calls. But some of the articles I was reading, Neil Gabler wrote an interesting piece on this, where he said, don't be shocked to see Trump's ratings go up because of who supports him and what that support means. And he could possibly be a two-term president because of that, because it doesn't seem that the opposition doesn't even know who they are. You know, that there's how you define it.
And Mark, we have to say he's good. We can disagree with the stuff that he said, but to just look at what this man did, he took down two parties, 17 candidates on the right, the entire Democratic Party, no help, him, Rudy Giuliani, his kids, and he won the Electoral College in this country.
Because he's a master manipulator,
yes,
that's what it is.
But I'm saying, but you have to appreciate that there's a skill there. It may be a madman. We can all agree that he's a madman, and we don't agree that the ends justifies the means, but we can't discount his skill, which means we have to elevate the game at which we combat, resist, and affect what's going to happen over these next 4 years, because he has proven to be more than a worthy opponent. He is our president-elect, and that is a sad thing, but we have to understand that this is a man with incredible appeal and skill. And we've got to raise the game to make sure that we can minimize the damage that he can do.
We're going to have a very short break and come back. And we can also talk about the fact that, as Michael Moore keeps telling everybody, Hillary Clinton won the majority of the votes.
Yes, she did.
And what does that say about the Electoral College, which was based in our slavocracy?
Oh. Yes.
So we'll be right back with more. And let us go to the phones here when we come back. And Donna, you're the first caller up. We'll be right back. Welcome back, folks. This is Mark Steiner here at the Mark Steiner Show as we look at more analysis of this election, and we really are going to explore this next half an hour. What is it that people who call themselves progressives or liberals or people on the left do in these next 4 years? The young people in this country have already decided what they're doing in part, which is standing up and across the country. And you are seeing things happen in communities across America, like here in Baltimore, where we broadcast from. This Saturday, there's a meeting at 2640, where hundreds and hundreds of people are coming together from different parts of the community, from community organizers in the projects and in the west side of Baltimore, with people who are active in housing, with people who are who have demonstrated against police brutality in the city, and other people are coming together to talk about what their response should be. And so that kind of movement is building. Where does that take us? What does that mean? And we're here with Quincy Gamble, a Democratic Party operative for a long, long time. He's been doing a lot of work in the unions and the Democratic Party. The Reverend Merrick Moyes, who is a community activist and one of the first African Americans ordained in the old Catholic movement. Sarah Van Gelder, executive editor and co-founder of Yes Magazine. I want to get to the phones here, but Sarah, well, let me get to the phones. And I do want to come back and talk a bit about where you think the movement goes from here. And what you maybe learn from the folks and brothers and sisters who are out there in Standing Rock, what they have to say to us. 410-319-8888. Donna, you're on the air. Welcome.
How you doing, Mark?
Very well, Donna.
Excellent show.
Thank you.
And your guests as well. The Democratic Party, to me, has always been a split party. It's white on one side and people of color and women on another. It's never been an all-inclusive party. It's not even run. It's not even diverse, even in how its makeup and who makes decisions and whatever like that. And, you know, that's my biggest problem with that party. In reference to winning of Donald Trump, I had predicted a year ago he was going to be a nominee, and I got laughed at by everybody. Then six months later, I said he's going to win. I got laughed and chewed out by everybody. You know, there's something, people have to look at what's going on in this country. Poverty is growing. The middle class is shrinking. There are no jobs. Everything is made overseas. That was a wake-up call for everybody to, and for both parties to understand that this is a party, I mean, this is a country that pretty much has people with no jobs. People are tired. So when I go out into the community on both sides, the rural, the urban areas, and the suburban areas, the young people see that something's wrong, and they're angry. And we as people in this country need to really wake up to what Donald Trump has done. He's woken up all these hidden secrets and quietness and made people realize that we have not progressed as well as we should have. And my final point is, the first 2 years of his term is going to be interesting to watch, because I really believe that in order to save this country, I think the wife and his daughter are going to be the ones. His wife and daughter are going to be the ones that are going to. His wife and daughter are going to need to. Going to have to help to bail him out and make him and wake up. So, I mean, I just wanted to see what your opinion is concerning his party and how what's going to happen reference to the Supreme Court, the Roe versus Wade,
right,
et cetera. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Donna.
Yesterday on 60 Minutes, Trump was asked about Roe versus Wade, and he says it should go to the states. It's settled law. He doesn't see it overturned, but it will change. And then so Leslie Stahl says, well, that may mean that women may have to go out of state for abortions. And he said, well, they'll just have to go out of state. Now, when we talk about being in touch, right, that's completely out of touch. And so as people that are working on the ground, how do we support women and female-bodied persons in these particular positions? Resistance doesn't just look like marching in the street. Resistance looks like opening up small food pantries in your local area and feeding people who don't have. It looks like providing support for folks, be it hotlines, being available able to talk for people who are in complete distress. That's what it looks like.
So but Sarah Van Gelder, it looks like that, but it also it seems to me that the question I was coming to, you have maybe have to feed people, maybe walk through the streets, but you've got to organize.
Absolutely.
You can't just, I mean, so what is your vision of where you think this might be going?
Yeah, so that's one of the things I saw when I was traveling around the country to write the book that just came out, The Revolution Where You Live. And I both agree with what Reverend Moyes said, that we need to be there for each other in our local communities. We need to be ready to feed each other, to keep each other safe. And we need to use that as a foundation for rebuilding the political power to prevent more of this awfulness from happening, but also to rebuild the kind of economy we want, because there is such despair, there is such struggling on a day-to-day basis. People feeling so insecure. There was one of the surveys I read recently said if you needed $400 because an emergency came up, how many Americans would have that money without having to borrow it or
right.
You know, there's only half of Americans would actually be able to come up with $400 for an emergency, and so many emergencies cost that or more.
Right.
So people are living with this enormous sense of insecurity. Of course, most people, or a great number of women, can't just pick up and go to another state to get an abortion if they need it. So that is, you know, we need to be looking at that. And we just published an article on Yes Magazine about how in Sweden and Norway, during one of their most divisive periods, when things seem to be, you know, as bad as they are in this country, it was in part building up a local economy, you know, getting together at the local level and rebuilding cooperatives and rebuilding all of those institutions that also become a power base, by the way, to prevent fascism, because, you know, that is what we're facing. It's that combination of organizing, of resistance, creating also the new things that we need to make our lives better. When we do those things together, we become far more powerful. And I think that's really what we need to be looking for. And that's also what I found out at Standing Rock. I just got back from spending 2 weeks there. And they're doing the same thing. You know, they spend a lot of the time out at these water protectors' encampments, as they call them. They spend a lot of time feeding, you know, cooking and feeding each other, building houses or structures for the winter, finding ways just to, you know, to make life work on a daily basis for the hundreds and sometimes thousands of people coming through. And at the same time, they're going out and, you know, doing what they can to make sure that pipeline doesn't go through. They're going out and putting their bodies on the line, putting tents on the line, working nonviolently in profound ways to disrupt the further diminishment of their lives as Native people, to protect their waters, and doing all of that with this central focus on prayerfulness and inclusiveness and nonviolence. A bunch of youth, when I was there, a group of youth did a silent prayer walk up to the front lines and brought water and gave it to the police officers standing up there. So there's this profound ethos of resistance. You know, we're just not going to back down. We're not going to allow our water to be poisoned. We're not going to allow these sacred sites to be desecrated. And at the same time, this sense of we're going to build something together that works here and now and sustains us all.
I want to go right to the phones here. Wayne, and then Owusu and Charles are going to be on the air. But I have a quick question, Quincy. Mm-hmm. As a friend of mine who's worked inside the Democratic Party for a long time, is what Sarah is describing, is that something outside the party? Maybe the party doesn't have the wherewithal to do that. Maybe it takes people, maybe it has to be pushed from the bottom and out to transform itself, if it can be transformed, if it can be transformed. And does that have anything to do with the people you know inside the party?
Well, the party is fairly regimented. That's sort of how the party has existed, and we
like
are
all parties.
All parties, not just the Democratic Party of the Obama era. Okay, all parties are fairly regimented, and they exist for a way. Now, so there is a progressive coalition that I think will have to reorganize itself to work alongside the actual party to make sure that we are organizing at the local level.
But does it work alongside the people Sarah's talking about that are actually in the streets and the communities doing the work?
I think you need it all. I think they all have to complement one another. I think they all have to exist in these same spaces. Where we are now, and like the good Reverend said, is that there are so many folks in peril and in danger. you're going to have to organize around those specific issues. Absolutely. To make sure we are taking care of our gay and lesbian, transgender brothers and sisters. You are going to have to organize specifically around the issue to make sure that we are preserving women's rights. You're going to organize specifically around the issues to make sure that minorities are respected and their rights
but,
are
But what
held
happens
up.
Inside that party?
Yeah. Well, right now we're looking for a new leader.
When Black Lives Matter, when Standing Rock, when community organizers, when people who are fighting around racism, when people who are fighting for the in poor communities to have a different way of life and housing people can afford and food people can afford.
When are you asking, is there room at the party's table?
No, there is not, I don't think, at the moment.
Okay.
To kind of push
yes.
that elite leadership around Chuck Schumer and all the Wall Street people.
I would agree.
Say, you know, that
I would agree.
You know?
I would agree.
Absolutely.
There's a tension there.
Yes.
It's very explosive.
Yes.
I would even argue,
which is what elected Obama and what didn't elect Clinton. Because
yeah.
they thought people saw the embodiment of the future in the face of a black man and went, this is where America could go.
Right.
And people got excited and then it dissipated.
Reality hit.
Right.
I mean, I also would say that on the state level, too, we have that type of mentality that's not really in touch with actually what's going on with the people. When I do voter education, I'm always asking people, please talk to your legislators, because there are a good swath that don't know what's happening on the ground or in the streets. They just don't know. And we must form coalitions that will advocate for ourselves. We have this big thing with the DOJ report and consent decree. And then we're hearing voices coming out of the General Assembly saying that criminal justice reform is not on the menu this session. When we know what is happening in these streets regarding law enforcement and citizens, how can we say we're just not going to do it this year when somebody's life is on the line? We have to coalesce and create coalitions that will demand, not ask, but demand that this change, because people's lives are at stake, period, point blank. I'm sorry your 401k might be overturned in the apple cart of this distress in terms of the corporate folks, but we need to do this. The party needs to respond now and completely, and it needs to be new leadership. I hear the representative from Minnesota, Ellison.
Keith Ellison
is vying for to run the party, and I think we ought to look at that brother and see his credentials and take him seriously as a viable candidate for the position of the head of that party.
Let me go to the phones here. Yeah. He is a good guy, but the progressive caucus has to kind of learn what it means to organize. They spend too much time trying to get money from corporations and not enough time and talking.
Reed.
410-319-8888. Owusu, you're on the air. Welcome.
Yes, and good morning, Mark, and to your guest.
Good morning.
Good morning.
You know, oftentimes it's said that poor white folks vote against their own interests to get back at us. But I'm thinking that in this last election, a lot of black folks, particularly in the South, voted against their own interests. If you're looking at Clinton versus Bernie Sanders, and that if the vote had been different, then Bernie Sanders would have probably been the candidate. So what your comments on that, and also what implications does that have for the future in terms of trying to attract people of color to progressive ideas?
I would say in terms of what happened with Sanders Clinton in the South, one of the problems that I think the Sanders campaign had, and this is actually talking to people who were in that camp, is that his message did not get out in time. And so the relationships, we have to realize that Mr. and Mrs. Clinton have built relationships within the black community for the last 30 years. And although Bernie's ideas were squarely in alignment with what's going on with the black working class, the good portion of it is the message did not get out. And many people, you know, we have relationships, right? So a lot of what we do as black people are built on relationships. And so if you come into me, I don't know you, but I know them, I'm going to go with the people that I know as opposed to the people that I don't. And I think that was the problem, that he should have created, that his message should have gotten out much earlier. I'm talking not months, but years ahead in preparation for his run.
Well, one thing I will say about Bernie Sanders is, let's go back to the phones here, is that when confronted by Black Lives Matter, unlike when Clinton was confronted by Black Lives Matter, he actually listened and changed his thoughts and worked with that. And then, and that first day when they jumped up on the young kids jumped up on the platform and took over, and he was like sitting in shock. But right after that, he went, "Wait a minute, what am I missing here?"
And this is a strange campaign.
And
I'm
put
just
his arms around. Young people who
and
are
that shows
that
the generational divide because as we talked, Mark, we know that Black millennials were really very much in the Sanders camp, as opposed to older Black folks, 35 and older, who went for Clinton.
Let's go back to the phones. We're going to go back to Sarah Van Gelder, 410-319-8888. Charles, you're on the air.
Hey, Mark.
Good morning, Charles.
Morning. I'm just curious. You know, what I saw with Democrats. First of all, Democrats have to self-explain. Because you could see it in the midterm elections, what was going on in this country. And my observations were oftentimes because the LGBT community was being served, because other special interests were being served, there's a huge segment that's part of the Democratic Party whose voices were just shouted down. If you said one of these key words or you said something that somehow rubbed one of those folks the wrong way, right away they would label you and drown you out. And I think it's that alienation that made those folks go in another direction. I mean, because they talk about the other side, not ever wanting to work with them, but you'd be surprised at how close-minded folks are within the party. You can look at Baltimore City. If you say anything that doesn't go along with the party line, especially if you're Black, they right away label you a Republican, they shout you down, and you can't say another word. And that's been my experience. And I voted for Mrs. Clinton, you know, because I'm a Democrat. But I find that our party's not as open-minded as we purport ourselves to be. And I think that has to change. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Charles.
That's hard to hear. It's just really hard.
And I think in many ways it's very real. Sarah, so I'm curious what all the stuff you've written about, all the things you've seen over these last years as the editor of Yes and the people you've talked around the country, where do you see this going? Because, you know, Yes takes a very positive view in many ways. Critical analysis, but positive view from the people's perspective. But I'm curious where you think this all takes us.
Well, I think we've fallen into the trap of believing that that there isn't enough dignity to go around. Hmm. And I think some of the most powerful political leaders, people like President Obama, have been the ones who've said every single person in our country deserves dignity. They deserve to live in a good standard of living, and you know we need to make that happen. And I think we need to recapture that. We being progressives, I think Clinton's description of the deplorables was a signal that there are certain categories of people that she was willing to write off, just as Donald Trump has written off certain categories of people. I think that's a huge mistake because I think everybody in this country, you know, can live in dignity, and that's the aspiration that we need to have at a national level. And a lot of that does get back to the economy, and I apologize for keep coming back to that.
That's okay.
But as long as people don't have access to decent jobs, and it's not enough to say the unemployment rate has gone down, if the unemployment rate is going down because people are working low-wage jobs, working two or three jobs just to get by, that's not dignity. That's not living a secure life. We need to really rethink that. And there is enough wealth in this country. If it's distributed appropriately, there is enough for everyone to have a decent standard of living. It's not enough to treat people, for example, our veterans. A lot of people, you know, believe that if they're getting disability payments or something, if they're getting some kind of basic subsistence, that should be enough. But that's not a dignified life either. People need to feel like they're contributing, like they're valued for who they are, no matter who they are. And if we can't work that out, I think, and that's where I keep coming back to the local level, because I think there, instead of labeling one another, instead of labeling people as the deplorables or labeling people as racists, we have to realize how flawed we all are and say, okay, let's roll up our sleeves, let's do some serious introspection about how racism and homophobic and so forth have gotten such a strong foothold in our country. But let's also get to know each other as human beings and then move ahead together and create communities and institutions that work for ordinary people. And if that means taking on those big corporations, that's what it means. And I think that's where the Democratic Party has fallen short so often, is that is that the bias is, oh, well, Wall Street and the interests of the big corporations have to be protected at all costs, and then we can do some stuff around the edges. And we have absolutely got to drop that, because those policies that favor big corporations are undermining the ability of the American people to live in dignity.
So I know you both want to say something here. Some callers here have some interesting things to say on that regard. You want to jump in very quickly?
I just want to ask her a question, but I can wait. I want to ask her a question, but I can wait.
Well, we can't equivocate on people's dignity. So I understand that we do have to focus on economics. But let's not throw LGBT people under the bus conveniently because people are bigoted. And so now there's...
She wasn't doing that.
No, I'm not talking about our fellow guest. I was talking about the caller before that. Like, let's not play this game like it's the gaze of economics. Let's not do that because it's not that.
Right.
So let's see what folks have to say out there very quickly. There's a lot of people calling in. Clearly, there's a lot going on here. We don't have much time left, but let's get some calls in here and see what people are thinking. And Wayne, you're on the air. Then we're going to go to John and try to get to Dale. Wayne, you're on the air. Welcome.
Yes. I'd like to first say I think the one of the biggest downfalls of the Democratic nominees this time was the pick of the vice president. Vice president was very weak, very not inspirational to the masses at all. Had she picked somebody like Bernie or Michelle Obama?
That wasn't going to happen. I mean,
somebody who inspired the people. Vice president pick did not inspire the people, okay? And as far as the corporations go, yes, the Democratic Party did swing wide to the right to encompass the corporations so they felt comfortable enough to hand them money, boatloads of money and everything. But I think the biggest thing that you didn't understand was the angry white voter. Because the angry white voter hasn't won enough, even though he wins every time, there's a choice, between this person or that person. They come out smiling and smell like roses and everything. They, for some reason, they don't think it's quite enough, and that's where we're losing, because people like myself, keep winning and it's just not enough.
We appreciate the calls. Get a quick thought from John and come back to our panel. John, you're on the air. Welcome.
I think of a book written before this election, Thomas Frank's Listen Liberal, which seemed to lay out the whole damn thing.
Good book.
About where the Democratic Party is going and how this is going to end up. Secondly, I think that the progressive has got to move away from all the racial identity and all the racial obsession. Because, let's face it, Donald Trump, when he picks the Supreme Court justices, affirmative action is finished. It's going to be gone across the board. I don't mean Bakke or something like that. It's going to be gone, finished. It's not going to be there. And when you look at some of this election, some of these counties, where, after all the talk about white supremacy and people being driven insane by a black family in the White House, you look at these counties, and in 2008 they voted for Obama, in 2012 they voted for Obama, in 2016 they voted for Trump, and I'm thinking all these people, they voted for Obama, didn't know he was black in 2008, in 2012 he didn't realize a black family was in the White House, and they were completely demonized as white supremacists and all this nonsense. And I think the left has got to go back, basically, and go back and become a party for working people of all races and realize that, that's the way it has to go. And just because you're black or LGBT or whatever, and you're a bloody multimillionaire, and you're a friend of Bill and a friend of the Clintons, it doesn't mean you necessarily have anything in common with working people, whether they're black, whether they're brown, whether they're white, whatever. And that's all I have to say.
John, thanks so much. So we have 4 or 5 minutes we have left here. I'll try to get on the call, but let's tackle what he just said, because this is going to be part of the debate. what happened in the last 16 years, that racism has been called out in this country for the depth that it has and the grip it has in society. And then you have voices like John are saying, okay, but you can't keep talking about race.
That's a lie. We're not going back. I'm sorry. We're not going back, because in order for this nation to heal and move forward, we have to talk about it. We have to. Now, there are frames that we can talk about it. We can talk about it from a human lens. How do we work? How do we move forward in a humanistic way? But we cannot deny the history of racism and how racism hurts not just people of color, but also white folks as well, because white resentment and all of that is setting this situation up.
I just want to agree with that. I
agree too.
I don't believe we can go backwards. And, you know, I think the Movement for Black Lives and Black Lives Matter have done an enormous service to the whole country to raise up these issues, to really force people like Bernie, but people across the board, to confront a lot of these issues. I think it's really interesting that young people are so much more tuned into this question and I think are moving forward. So in some ways, I think of the Trump presidency as like the last gasp of white entitlement. And I think it's on its way out, and it absolutely has to be, and we need to keep working on that.
If we organize the right way, I would definitely affirm the comments of my fellow guests here and say that we are in a moment here where there is a tremendous amount of opportunity. No one can overstate the disappointment that we feel about this moment in history where we are. But there is, and it's almost great to see the young activism, because they don't know what the party or what the movement should be. So they're coming at it full speed ahead, gusto, and I applaud that. In this moment that we're in, I've chosen to be introspective about what I can do better, what is my place in this movement, and how I can be a better citizen, a better practitioner of politics. And I don't have to agree with the folks who are out there espousing views different from mine, but I do think we have to hear them. We can't continue to live in this country as a divided country where we walk past one another, we don't see each other's views, and we demonize the opposition. There's a lot there to not like about Donald Trump. But the folks who voted for him, they are our fellow citizens. And we have to find a way to build this bridge, to build a coalition of progressive change that will keep moving forward.
So, you know, one of the things that made me think of here is a conversation we had with Bob Zellner just a couple of weeks ago about white working class votes in America. He was part of a roundtable we had, former leader of SNCC, who grew up in Alabama, and a Klan family. That his father left the Klan. And he reminded me of what Fannie Lou Hamer said, and I'll never forget this. Fannie Lou Hamer said when they were organizing poor white farmers and poor black farmers together in Mississippi back in the mid-late 60s, Fannie Lou Hamer said, I don't care if they're in the Klan. Once they get over here, they're going to change when we struggle together. And that was basically what, you know, which is
same thing that Jesse Jackson said in West Virginia back in the 80s.
When he ran for president.
Absolutely. So, organizing the mine workers of West Virginia. The exact same premise.
It would be an interesting conversation to have about racism, and organizing in America and how you do that. Because we have all these points of view have come on the show from let's be more insular in the black community and kind of just take care of ourselves and not worry about what's going on out there, to the Fannie Lou Hamer point of view as well. So it would be really interesting to have that kind of ranging discussion about where this takes us. Because we do have to have that introspection to figure out where are we going.
And a lot of these voters voted for President Obama. We cannot lose. Secretary Clinton lost white working class voters that voted for Obama. It happened. So we can't say it's all racism. Yes, there's a lot of racism that's prevalent in this vote and where we sit today. But we lost some votes that we got in 08 and 12.
We are at the break point. This has been a great conversation.
Yes.
I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Quincy Gamble, thank you, brother, for coming
Sarah,
in.
Sarah, I'm a big fan. Love your stuff.
Oh, thank you. Appreciate that.
Sarah Van Gelder, executive editor, co-founder of Yes Magazine. Maybe I'll meet you up there in Standing Rock. I gotta get up there. And the Reverend Merrick Moore, good to have you in the studio again, man.
Thank you so much. We got to move towards a humanistic framework, y'all. Humanism.
And resist.
All right.
Thank you all.
Thank you so much.
Thank you all.
Resist.
We have to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to take a look at the local election here in Baltimore and what Trump might say to that and where we go next in this city. Where are we going? Stay with us.